On this episode of Skeptico, Mike Leyland.
I look at the UFO phenomena and I am challenged to either fit it into that framework or say that it lies outside of that framework. So are the aliens God?
I'm sure you could cherry pick the reports and you could come up with that answer that they are God. In these narratives, these UFO abduction narratives, people come back and they tell what they experienced. And so one person in one narrative, you know, asks the little gray aliens, you know, they ask, are you angels? And the gray aliens reply, yes, but not in the way you think of angels, which is an interesting answer. On another report, someone asks, did God create the universe? And the aliens reply, no, God is creating the universe moment by moment. I feel like I'm constantly confronted with, and the term I will use is something's going on behind the curtain. You know, I'm implying that there's this other dimensional realm that they, these aliens, can access that we can barely access. Maybe we can access it through death. Maybe we can access it through psychedelics. Maybe we can access it through intense meditation or through dream realms. You know, we can access that realm fleetingly.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and as you just heard from that introduction, we're going to be talking about the UFO phenomena. And there I am tiptoeing around what we're really going to be talking about, and that is the reports of contact with this other consciousness that seems to be connected to the UFO phenomena. Now, this is a very challenging topic for a lot of folks. This is clearly a taboo topic. You touch it and you're immediately ostracized. You're immediately put in an out group by so many people. Yet the connections to the broader question of what human consciousness is are unavoidable. I mean, we keep butting up against it over and over again, whether it's in psychedelics or whether it's in remote viewing, mediumship. No matter where you go, you follow the trail long enough and you'll start hearing about this connection with these other beings. So it's a topic I think we really, really have to delve into to try and get our arms around it and understand just what's going on. My interview with Mike Leyland was a great start. He's a great guest. It's a long interview. Let's get right to it. Today we welcome Mike Leyland to Skeptico. In addition to being a pretty amazing illustrator, Mike is also a blogger and podcaster at hiddenexperience.blogspot, where he tackles a number of paranormal topics, mainly centered around alien contact. Now, I know that can be a challenging topic for those who haven't really studied the phenomena very much, but I'm really hoping that in this Skeptico interview, we can jump past all that first level skeptical silliness. If you think all this stuff is swamp gas and ball lightning, then more power to you. But that's not really what we're going to talk about today. What I'm hoping to get into with Mike is questions about this other form of consciousness that many, many folks seem to be coming in contact with, and then hopefully trying to tie that back to so many of the topics that we've talked about here on Skeptico, be it remote viewing or out-of-body experience or near-death experience, lucid dreaming, psychedelics, all the rest. So with that rather long introduction, Mike, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Yes.
Well, I'm really excited to talk to you because I've been listening to so many of your interviews, and not just on a need to be informed for the show, but because they're great. I really like them. You have a great way on the mic. It's very natural, very personable, and very personal. You come through with a lot of your own personal information that doesn't get in the way, but just enhances the experience. And of course, you have a lot of great guests. So it's really a delight to listen to, and it's a real joy to have you on the show.
Well, great. Thanks. In the genesis of the whole podcasting series has been and I'm not exaggerating, and I repeat this over and over again, is it's been therapy for me. It's been a form of self-therapy. I feel like I'm stepping into waters that are, you know, pretty murky and pretty deep, and in a way venturing into the unknown as far as I try to sort of untangle some of these threads. And I've had some personal experiences, and the podcast series and the interview stuff has been a way for me to I almost want to say like be on the therapist's couch in a way, you know, like I'm using them. It's a selfish act, the podcast series that I'm doing. It's in a way for me alone. You know, all that said, you know, I have had similar feedback to you where people sort of tap into that in a way where they get something out of it, I guess.
Well, that's great. And I think it's always a selfish act a little bit whenever we broadcast like this. I mean, one way or another, you're getting something out of it in order to continue doing it. And that's good that you're taking something out of it. Let's give people a sense for the kind of folks you've interviewed and what they've brought to your show and what you're trying to kind of get at. I wanted to try and hit on some names that folks would immediately recognize. So which one would you maybe pick out first that folks would immediately identify with?
Well, it's interesting because there's almost like two layers to the interview format that I'm doing. As far as the folks that have been on there, I guess I've got about 70 interviews posted at this point. Some of them are shorter, some of them are two parts and such. But you know, you would certainly recognize the name Whitley Strieber, who I've had on, and I've met him a few times. He's obviously the fellow who wrote Communion and published that, I think, in 1987, sort of ushering in the entire UFO abduction lore, you know, the mythology and so many of the puzzle pieces that are entwined in that, came directly from that book.
But Mike, wait a minute, let me jump in there right off the bat, because I can already see there's so many areas that we can pull apart and pathways we can go down. So Whitley, as you just mentioned, is a sci-fi writer. He comes out and writes a very personal story about his alien contact experience. It ushers in a huge explosion in interest and research into alien contact and whether or not folks have had real physical contact with aliens, what that might mean, whether it's a purely psychic interdimensional experience, whether it's a physical experience, whether it's a spiritual experience. So it really starts this whole thing. But I really resist the idea, and I understand where you're going when we talk about mythology, because there's a bunch of other folks that have taken the whole UFO contactee experience and gone down this path of this is somehow mythological in a non-real sense. And pull that apart for us a little bit. And where do you stand on that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's a can of worms in the sense that it's all of that. I mean, it can frame itself within all of that context. I like the term mythology just because it allows me to step back a little bit and not be so tied in to like, I mean, there's very little concrete reality that you can grasp in this. There certainly is physical evidence. There certainly are multiple witness reports of abduction. People who get abducted with other people. So multiple people will come back, share the same story independently. That term abduction, I feel like I'm a little stuck using that term. I don't like it. I wish there was a different vocabulary word. Some people will say experiencer, that has its own baggage. Some people will say contactee, that has its own implications. Some people will use the direct contact. We'll say like the direct contact experience. I'm kind of using the pop culture term we all know, which is UFO abduction.
Mike, let me jump in there again, and
This is great. This is great.
Okay, because I want to make sure we don't jump ahead too far and have people just clicking off and going, that's it, I'm out, you know, because you just blew past the first major fulcrum point, if you will, in this whole thing. And that's that if we take these accounts and we try and understand them as best we can in a social science kind of way, right? So we have these first person accounts, and there's a lot of first person accounts in science in general, right? They're in medicine, as we've talked about so many times on this show, it's the essence of medicine. It's the bread and butter of medicine. The patient comes in, what is their first person account? And we take first person accounts from a number of patients, and then we draw together what are the symptoms, what are the factors, and then we can do a lot of stuff beyond that. But these first person accounts are very important, and we have some tools in science by which we can establish whether those first person accounts are real in the sense that we normally use that word, whether they're delusional or whether the person is confabulating or making something up. And what I didn't want to blow past is by the best evidence we have, the first person accounts suggesting that large numbers of people have had a contact with another being that they understand to be an extraterrestrial, that evidence is overwhelming. And we get it from a breadth of different accounts, and we also get it, as you said, from getting different people who've had a shared experience by which they would have no way of kind of knowing that without having that kind of genuine shared experience. So can you maybe take a couple of minutes and address that, of that there is some realness to this whole thing that we can't dismiss out of hand. And I want to say, I want to back up one more time and say, this is important, and it's an important distinction from that real skeptical silliness that I mentioned, that, you know, oh, that all that UFO stuff is nonsense. I mean, if you're in that camp, you can't even have a seat at the table. But I think there's a number of people that are willing to accept that, yeah, there seems to be these unexplainable objects in the sky that defy our understanding of engineering and aeronautics and all that. I accept that, and are still reluctant to kind of go that next step in terms of, wow, maybe all these accounts of people having some direct experience with these beings, maybe there's some reality to that. So can you backtrack and give us your best guess on where all that shakes out?
It's a can of worms. It's you know, it's a very muddy subject in the sense that what you're asking is difficult. But what is happening is that people are reporting very similar events. The events would be an interaction with some sort of non-human entity. And you said something like you actually made a little leap where you said that the aliens would be extraterrestrial in origin, or there's actually very little evidence of that. What the term alien, when you look it up in Webster's, it doesn't really say anything about a being from another planet. Alien has its own definition, and it means something so different that it is actually unknowable in some way. I'm paraphrasing. I mean, that's not a direct, I'm not lifting that right out of the dictionary in front of me here. But so what people are interacting with. And also, I would also say, I use the term intertwined all the time. What people seem to be somehow connected or intertwined with is something very different from our normal state of consciousness and our normal state of interaction. That there's things that show up in these reports over and over and over again that are so similar, and that a lot of these things have entered the pop culture. The caricature of what happens is that someone is asleep in their bed. They are woken by small gray aliens with big black eyes, and then they are somehow ushered into a flying saucer, and medical examinations take place, and then they are ushered back to their bed. And in the morning or afterwards, they either have fleeting memories or no memories at all, or memories emerge later, or they have phobias and fears. sometimes these memories are retrieved through hypnotic regression, which is controversial within the UFO community, the UFO research community. You know, some people are all for it, some people are against it. But that little narrative, that short narrative, is certainly part of it. That certainly shows up. But what doesn't really make it into the pop culture, and I think partially just because it can't be easily encapsulated into a, you know, a half hour long documentary on late night cable TV, what is missing is that there is stuff intertwined with this phenomena that is so intensely bizarre that it forces you to re-examine the definition of reality itself. The people who have these experiences and there's lots and lots of experiences that take place in cars at night with multiple people. There's multiple experiences, you know, that basically, you know, where the abduction, the contact experience takes place in full daylight outside, and with all these paranormal elements, time seems to change, sound seems to change, the actual personality of the individual seems to change. They almost shift into an altered state of consciousness, as well as an altered as an alternate identity. At times, I mean, these are things that get reported commonly that never show up in the, you know, in the mainstream. Here's where I'm sort of going with my, and I'm very skeptical, I'm very cautious to call it research, because I don't even know what, if I'm doing this as research. I'm not a scientist, I'm not a sociologist, I'm not a psychiatrist, I've got no sort of training in this. I feel like I'm more just, someone seeking out answers in the dark, and trying to find patterns. And partially, it's very seductive. I mean, these stories are so interesting and so bizarre that I'm drawn to them. And then at another level, you know, they're very real human experiences. Some people are traumatized, literally, you know, like they lose their ability to function. That's at one end of the spectrum. Other people, I almost want to use the term enlightened. You know, they have there's a spiritual aspect to this that can transform people and can alter their life path in a way that almost would, you know, I almost want to say, like, you know, meeting God on the road to Damascus or something like that would be the same analogy. You know, they come away and then some people, you know, do take on a sort of religious zeal to the whole aspect. I'm trying to, you know, and then the researchers that are in the community that are trying to make sense of this, many of them would be, let's say, guilty of being pigeonholed and only focusing on a small little element of it. But these there's certainly physical traces that show up. The people with marks on their bodies after these experiences, or, you know, after unknown experiences, poltergeist experiences. I cannot tell you how many people I've had direct conversations with that say, in no uncertain terms, after this experience, I've become psychic. That shows up over and over and over again. That does not get played out in the mainstream, the documentation or the, you know, I keep on going back to these documentaries that we'll see on cable TV. You know, you don't hear that in the documentaries, but that is so integral to the overall phenomenon, like a new sense of psychic awareness. A lot of people will actually start working as psychics. I can't speak to the authenticity of this, but it certainly is a pattern. I've interacted with some psychics and done some psychic sessions and actually posted them online, which I thought were quite profound. And these were people who have been having, what we would call the classic UFO abduction contact experience.
You know, that launches us into another, I don't know if we're ever going to be able to unravel this interview, Mike. But again, in the spirit of the way that you do it, I did want to also comment. You know, the other thing I like about your interviews is they have a free form, natural flow to them that I think is great. So we're going to kind of follow that here. We're going to let this thing go wherever it goes. And we may not get back to even the very first question that I started with, which is all these very interesting, fascinating guests that you've had on, including Richard Dolan and Nick Redfern and Peter Robbins and many, many, many people that folks would probably recognize that are, if they're at all interested in this topic. But you just kind of ventured into a territory that I did want to spend some time talking about, and that's the connection between what you're observing within the UFO community and the contactee community, the connection between that and some of the things we've observed in this consciousness community that's interested in OBEs, near-death experiences, and the like. And I don't know if you've listened to this show, but we've done a couple of shows on what's broadly called spiritually transformative experiences. So NDEs often fall into this category because people have an NDE and they're transformed spiritually. But there's a number of other ways that people can seem to encounter these kind of life experiences that really get to their core and get to their spirituality and shift it in a dramatic way. So one is the Kundalini experience, which has been explored in Hindu literature and religion for a long time. And people have this tremendous surge of energy that goes through their body. There's a similar kind of experience that happens often in the Christian community. People in the Catholic Church will talk about doing the rosary and, you know, having this flood of experience. And it has a lot of connections with the kind of phenomena that you're talking about. And that's that one, increased psychic ability. Sometimes it's dramatic and sometimes it's very unsettling, but people will be very, very psychic. And a lot of times they'll say that that was for a short period of time, a couple of weeks, a couple of months, and then it kind of closes back down. The other connection with what you're saying is that there's often a physical shift in people and that they feel physically changed as well as spiritually changed. So I think there's a lot of these connections that offer these interesting little tidbits. I don't know how far we want to go down that path, but there do seem to be these connections between the two experiences.
You know, yeah, I agree. One of the things I ask a lot of folks, you know, there's a handful of questions I try to ask everyone. And one of them is, in a way, what's your definition of a shaman? And, you know, I kind of know the answer I want to get. Everyone gives me a different one, but there seems to be, like, the shaman isn't, no one volunteers to be the village shaman. It's my understanding that the shaman is picked by the elders within the village, often through some sort of ceremonial means. And then there's an initiation process with that, you know, young person who will take over the role of the village shaman. And that initiation process, you know, across the board can be brutal. Whether metaphorically or, you know, sometimes actually quite literally, they will take the initiate right to the edge of death. So there's a death and rebirth process. That's part of it. You know, it's not uncommon for, this is coming from reading a lot of Joseph Campbell, where they'll take the initiate out to the edge of the village, they'll take him into a cave, they'll, you know, beat him up to the edge of death, and then they'll bring him out of the cave. I see a lot of parallels to that and to the UFO alien contact experience, where on some level, it seems to be an initiatory the framework within it.
But Mike, isn't that a difficult path to go down? I mean, when we start, and we encounter it, the same thing in the consciousness community, and that's that, you know, we have this experience, this spiritually transformative experience, or in particular, the near-death experience because it's been studied scientifically, medically, so thoroughly that we can really grab onto it and say, okay, there's some realness by any way we want to measure it. There's some realness to that. And then there's the next leap into the content of it, you know? And again, here's another parallel. If you go on to like NDERF.org, where Dr. Jeffrey Long has collected over 2,000 near-death experience accounts, and these are self-reported accounts, and they're all over the board. I mean, they're whatever you want to find there, you can find there. If you want to find this as a Christian experience, you can find that. If you want to find it as a shamanic experience, you can probably find that. So again, the parallel with the abduction contactee phenomena in that there's a whole range of different accounts that get written back. But I'm really reluctant to try and find too much of a pattern there or too much of a narrative that flows all the way through, because it seems to break down. And just from our own experience with this stuff, we know that there's a lot of blind alleys that we're going to head down that way. So that's one part of it. And then the other is, aren't a lot of people going to be deeply offended by the notion that someone coming in and being taken against their will and having medical experiments performed on them is somehow an initiation that they should be grateful for?
You know, I don't know if the initiate in the you know, the tribal village is grateful for his, you know, being dragged off to that cave. Yeah, you know, these experiences they're like a Rorschach blot, you know, what ink blot, Rorschach test, where you can peer into them and sort of glean whatever you want out of them because they're so all over the map. You know, when you listed off the near death experience, how they could be Christian and Hindu and shamanic and transformative, that, you know, that you're in essence describing the, you know, what gets reported by people who've had the UFO abduction experience. It is all over the map. I've sat in on, what would be referred to as like experiencer support groups, where a bunch of people sit in a circle in a closed room and talk about their experiences and share their experiences, just like any other support group, like Alcoholics Anonymous or something. But I've seen people actually, you know, the people who've had the angelic experiences get in shouting matches with the people who've had the evil doctor experiences on the medical exam table, because they're just on so. They're on such polar opposites of the way they've experienced this phenomena.
Great. Okay, hold on then. So how do we penetrate that? How do we penetrate that paradox? Because that's a little bit frustrating too. And we're deep into it now, folks. So if you're still with us, hang in there, because it's only going to get deeper. But there is a real point that interests me, fascinates me, is don't we have to, if we're going to play this game, and the game is that there is some reality that Mike and Alex are talking here, and we have some kind of shared experience on this earth, and that's reality, and a lot of other people share it. We're going to play that game of trying to figure out what that reality is. And I say it's a game because there's a whole other school of thought that this is somehow not a reality, or some kind of virtual reality, or anything like that we could go down. But let's put that aside for a minute and say there is some reality to it. Then I get to the point where you just did, and I feel a need to try and pin that down a little bit, because we have two opposite ends of the spectrum. I don't know how we can go forward saying, well, it could be either, it could be or, it could be both. We have to sort that out, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, I've, in a way, I've sort of given up sorting it out. What I've been more interested in is just listening to the direct human experience, the experience that people have had. Here, let me give an example. This is coming from my own experience. I had four different events where I felt this shift in consciousness, this altered reality is very difficult for me to describe. And I tried to describe it at one of these support groups. This took place at a UFO conference. There was probably 30 people sitting in this room. And I tried to, I said, I asked, has anyone else felt this? And I described this feeling of very quiet, very vivid, colors were heightened, my own thought process was streamlined. I didn't have like the normal chatter in my mind. And each of these four times was under unusual experiences. One time was actually in a dream where I felt it very clearly, that same sensation. Now, I asked about this and a few people raised their hands and nodded. And I said, hey, like after the meeting, you know, I'd love to just talk with folks. So this one woman came up to me and I'll also add that another thing I've been asking folks is what were they thinking about or saying or doing just before they had these contact experiences, or what would be a synchronicity or some sort of profound event in their life? What were they doing right at the moment when they were having that experience? So this woman came up to me and she said, yeah, here, I'll tell you the story of what happened to me. She said, I was in my yard. I went to the pecan tree that I have in my yard and I picked some pecans and I held them in my hand and I turned away. And then I turned back to face the tree. And when I did that, I felt that same experience that you were trying to describe. And we went back and forth and we agreed that we were, you know, using, it's very feeble to try to use vocabulary words to describe what would be sort of almost mystical experience. She felt that as she turned to face the tree after having picked the pecans. And then the next thing she knew, it was hours later, and she was sitting at her kitchen table. Just like there was just a jump cut in the edit of reality, and she had had a lifetime of odd experiences, including, you know, seeing little gray aliens in her bedroom. Now, I asked her, like, what were you thinking? What were you thinking right before you had that that sensation, that experience that then turned into a missing time experience? And she said, oh, I picked the pecans. I was walking away from the tree and I turned around because I wanted to like formally thank the tree for giving me the pecans. And I thought that detail, like this almost, you know, submissive to nature itself, thanking the tree, being grateful for food. I just thought that was such an intensely prescient detail to the whole, to her whole story. So I don't know where to go with that. You know what I mean? I've seen that pattern. I've seen people tell me stories like that, that add that extra richness to the overall phenomena that you wouldn't get unless you, I don't know, unless you were like me and you really wanted, I feel like I'm digging and searching with a kind of compulsion at this point, but I don't think you would have got, I would not have gotten that detail had I have not, you know, pressed her and asked her.
That's a great detail. Although I'm struck with the same question you are. I mean, where do you go with that? I think there's almost two lines of inquiry here. One is a personal sense of connection and deeper spiritual mystic kind of experience that we get from these accounts. And then there's the other kind of analytical, logical, scientific, what does this mean? How does this fit into some larger pattern? How do I sort these and assess the probability that they mean X versus Y?
Yeah, I'm not much of a linear thinker. I'm very much a creative type, very much an artist. So I feel like I'm approaching this less as a scientist and more as a poet. I know that sounds really lofty, but what it has allowed me to do is to, obviously I'm not going to abandon logical thinking, but I am going to trust my intuition.
That's fine. I think that's kind of a problem in our society in general, in that we have this idea of science that it somehow lies outside of these other modalities that we have, be it, you know, narrative or poetic or artistic, and it doesn't. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's the tools we bring to critically examine all this stuff. So I'd kind of push you on that a little bit and say, I think you're applying the best critical thinking you can. I mean, I've listened to enough of your interviews where you're getting to some junction point and you're saying, well, it's probably we would have to go this way because the predominance of evidence suggests that that's the way that the thing is. And also, I think that if we don't close down some of these doors, some of these possibilities, or look at them critically, I think we just wind up in kind of this no man's land where we're not really able to move forward. Because at the end of the day, I mean, the way I look at this, because we in the consciousness community, it's the same thing, you know, and people spin their wheels forever and look for more experiments and more, you know, if they're logically, scientifically oriented, they're looking for more experiments. If they're more on the touchy-feely narrative side, then they want more accounts. And at the end of the day, they don't really want to move forward. They just want to stay where they are. That's how it seems to me. And I think instead of that, what a lot of people are doing is they're trying to make real decisions about, this sounds really big, but it's the only way I can put it, how to live their life, how to make life decisions. People are trying to decide, you know, whether they should go to church or whether they should not go to church, whether they should be materially oriented and try and get the most stuff they can, or whether they should be more community oriented and try and reach out and connect with other people. There's all these life decisions that at the end of the day are all we have, I mean, in terms of who we are. And I think that the information that you're digging into can definitely inform those decisions. Just like that's the thing that always kind of amazes me about consciousness research, near-death experience research, is that it so directly, fundamentally, in your face, gets at those kind of issues that I just don't understand, one, people who don't seem to be very interested in it, or two, people who wind up being somewhat interested in it and reach some kind of agnostic position. Well, I don't really know. I can't really make a decision on that. Of course you can make a decision. You make a decision every day in the way you live your life. So aren't those the same issues that you're dealing with?
They are. I mean, one of the things I've been trying to unravel is people who have this experience. One of the questions I ask, similar to the shaman question, is like, hey, do you have any synchronicities in your life? And then the people who have had this kind of contact experience, and including the researchers, I'll say, when they get into a case, they will report all kinds of synchronicities. And the people who have the direct contact experience will just be flooded with synchronicities. And I felt all high and mighty, and I wrote a little essay on this, and I felt like I was Mr. Smarty Pants, that I was making this connection. And then this close friend of mine, you know, I said, hey, you know, UFO abductees have more experience or more synchronicities than the statistical norm. And she kind of rolled her eyes and she said, anyone on a spiritual path will have more synchronicities, which is true. And it forced me to say, like, wow, okay, so there is an element of this contact experience. It's very, there's a new agey side to it where it's very obvious that has, you know, where it feels like it is a spiritual path. I think that's the very definition of a spiritual path in a way, is to be wrestling with these grander questions.
But Mike, what does that mean to you? What does a spiritual path mean to you personally?
Well, I mean, on one level, I'm a cartoonist, so I picture this guy in a robe, walking in the desert.
You really do? That's what you really think of?
Well, I mean, it is a cartoon, sure. I mean, that would be the perfect New Yorker cartoon of someone on a spiritual path. I mean, that's ridiculously simplistic, but, I guess the spiritual path to me would be asking questions. I mean, I'm just coming right off my cuff here, asking questions from a heart-based, you know, from a very heart-based place, and then seeking the answers, you know, very difficult questions. I mean, you know, who am I? Why am I here? What's the meaning of all this?
Okay. So what are the answers you've found?
Well, I haven't found any to those, you know, the big questions.
Of course you have. You have. I have. We that's how we live our life.
Well, okay. For me personally, the answers would be, be honest, make your decisions from your heart rather than from your intellect. Obviously, you know, some decisions it's better to do from your intellect, you know, like when to get your, you know, brakes checked on your car. I think that's a good thing to do from an intellectual place. But, you know, how you interact with your fellow man, you know, should be done from a heart-based place. And then to recognize that, and this is for me, my spiritual path is to recognize that, you know, we as humans are fragile. So to come from a place of compassion when interacting with your fellow man.
Okay. So at the end of this life experience, what happens? There's this other consciousness. What is the nature of that other consciousness? Two more questions.
Yeah. So, you know, I've listened to your interview with Eben Alexander, and he painted that incredibly rich, almost psychedelic narrative from, you know, butterflies and beautiful angels and turning into dirt. And, you know, so whatever is going on, I think it's going to be multidimensional in a way that we can't articulate cleanly. We would have to use metaphor or story or mythology in an attempt to define what that otherworldly, grander dimensional realm is beyond the curtain. So, you know, I feel like, you know, reincarnation, sure, you know, maybe come back again, you know, life review, sure, that makes perfect sense.
But hold on for a second, because reincarnation, and in particular life review, suggests that there's some kind of order to consciousness, that it's somehow, in some way we might not fully understand, hierarchically structured. And that suggests that there's somebody sitting at the top of the pyramid. That's maybe switching into too much of a literal sense. But if there is an order, if there is a hierarchy, then that suggests God, more or less. Is that what you're saying?
God. I mean, with the universe, God, sure. I use the term the universe in replace. I grew up in a Lutheran family, and I, you know, it was about as low-key and non-intrusive kind of Christianity as could possibly exist. It was the 60s and guitars and stuff like that. So, I feel like I'm rebelling a little bit from that structured Christianity. And so I have a hard time saying God. I have a much easier time saying the universe. I'm saying the same thing. I'm just choosing a different vocabulary word because one has more baggage for me. So back to the UFO thing. So people report this bizarre stuff. I don't know what's true and what's not. I mean, no one reports the exact same thing. One report, and I'm paraphrasing this from memory, and I'm probably going to get some details wrong. Someone said that, you know, like, oh, on the moon, there's this machine, and the machine then takes our souls, and it uploads them. You know, I'm just thinking, like, you know, how, you know, I can upload and download things from one computer to another, you know, over the, you know, the wireless internet. So it uploads the souls after someone dies. It, you know, puts them through this formal process, and then it just recirculates them right back into the soul base here on Earth. Now, I don't really think there's a machine up on the moon that does this, but that is what someone shared. In what it felt to me like, I mean, they were very, very earnest in sharing this. They felt it. But you know, what it felt like, it was, you know, like, well, here's a mythology. Here's like this metaphor. You know, it may not be real, and it's always, to me, it's almost more, it's more fun to hear someone share a story that they think is real than it is, you know, to sort of ponder it in the abstract. But now here, I'll jump to one more thing. Dr. Leo Sprinkle, I think he's 82 years old now. He'll be 82 in early January. I think his birthday is January 1st. He'll be 82 in a couple of days. He's a researcher out of Wyoming who's been doing this for over 50 years, started in 1960 doing UFO research. One of the things he has done is he has a questionnaire that he created in 1960. He's been giving it to all his clients that claim this phenomena. So he's been giving the same questionnaire for 50 years. And one of the questions is, on this is, you know, meant to be given to, you know, UFO experiencers, people who see a UFO, people who claim the direct contact experience. One of the questions is, do you believe in reincarnation? And I'm doing this just off the top of my head. So, and what he's getting back from this questionnaire is that it's not 100%, but it's so close to 100% that it's striking. And that, and I don't know what the statistical norm is. If you asked, you know, a random sampling of people, it would be much lower than 100%. Do you believe in reincarnation? So that to me is a very interesting detail that 100%, well, close to 100% of the people who've had this experience believe in reincarnation.
Okay, well, let's run with those two data points. I'm going to pin you down here, Mike. I'm going to continue to pin you down. So the one data point is God. Okay, so there's God. Deal with it, whatever form. It doesn't have to be an old man with a white beard. It doesn't have to be a bald Buddhist. It's God. If we have that, and then we mix in the near-death experience, but we mix in just the most basic part that we can all kind of look at and agree with. And for the near-death experience, that would be this overwhelming experience of love. And if we also mix in from the near-death experience, this moral imperative, if you will, this directive to do things a certain way. There's a right way to do things. There's a wrong way to do things. And again, without layering on any kind of religious overtones on that, and you don't have to because you can pick your religion and they all say the same thing, the golden rule, do unto others. If I want to start from that standpoint and say that then becomes my lens with which I'm going to look at everything else, I look at the UFO phenomena and I am challenged to either fit it into that framework or say that it lies outside of that framework. So are the aliens God?
I think it depends. I'm sure you could cherry pick the reports and you could come up with that answer that they are God. Now, so I'm looking around my cabin here and I've got so many books and I won't be able to tell you exactly where I'm getting these references. These are just stuff I've read, that may or may not be true. So in these narratives, these UFO abduction narratives, people come back and they tell what they experienced. And so one person in one narrative, you know, asks the little gray aliens, you know, they ask, are you angels? And the gray aliens reply, yes, but not in the way you think of angels, which is an interesting answer. Now, on another report, I have, you know, it's one of these books on the shelf here. Someone asks the aliens, you know, they ask these big spiritual questions and they ask the angels, excuse me, they ask them there. I just did it. They ask the gray aliens, did God create the universe? And the aliens reply, no, God is creating the universe moment by moment, which is a, you know, that's almost like a Zen koan to get as an answer. Have you ever read the, there's a series of books called The Andreasen Affair, written by Raymond Fowler?
No.
Okay, it follows this one woman, Betty Andreasen, who is very Christian and sees the whole phenomena through sort of her own Christian ideology. I think there's four books in the series and then sort of a fifth book that is a final summation. So this woman, Betty, had and her and her kids and her parents and her husband, if they're to be believed, they've all had these abduction experiences. Now, she tells a story of being abducted, taking aboard a craft, interacting with the small gray aliens. The aliens escort her to, and if I'm remembering this correctly, it's almost like a little gray box. They're on the ship. They say, okay, here, now push the button on the box. So she pushes the button on the box, and the next thing she knows, she's taken through the tunnel. She's almost has a near-death experience where she's dragged through the tunnel. She emerges in this realm of white light, and before her is a giant eagle, a giant bird. And she looks at this bird, and then the bird is enveloped in flames, and then it shrinks down to ashes, and then from the ashes emerges this golden bird. And then from that golden bird, she has the overwhelming experience of you know, absolute love, of universal peace, of, you know, magical love, very much a communing with God. Then she, you know, whoosh, comes back through the tunnel. She's in the ship with the little gray aliens again, and they basically quiz her, like, "Well, how was it? You know, what happened? What did you think?" And she's transformed. She's like, "Oh my God, it was so beautiful. It was magical." Now, that same narrative shows up in other people's reports. In one report, quite literally the same, and then often in other reports, it's got difference without the mythological phoenix bird. So the implication to me, the way I read it, is that these aliens, you know, these little gray beings, are the way the questioning takes place. If these reports are to be believed, it sort of paints a picture where these little aliens are wrestling with these questions, you know, the same as we are.
Can you really say that they're wrestling with the questions? I mean, they're somehow, what I took from that narrative, and I'm getting it secondhand from you, is that they're able to access that dimension, that level of consciousness more readily than we are. But you can also take that, you know, and take the shamanic guru, you know, the Hindu lineage I'm kind of more familiar with. You know, there's countless number of people through the ages who claim to be able to access that realm and access that connection with God, with that all-loving being, almost instantaneously at will.
Yes. Now, if maybe I didn't describe it quite right, but the implication is that the little aliens can't get through that door. They can't get through that tunnel. There's that they are using, you know, they're almost creating, they're taking mortals, putting them through this process, and then asking them questions because they can't get through that door, because they are somehow, you know, whether they're on some alternate evolutionary track where they, you know, can't access that universal love. I mean, I don't know if this is, you know, this is the way it was framed in that narrative. And then I've had some direct conversation, or one direct conversation, where this woman spoke about this, and that was her take on it. So I'm sort of paraphrasing her take on this thing, that they are somehow incapable of receiving that love. And now if I jump back on a grand metaphoric level, you know, these little gray aliens, on some level, it doesn't take too much to perceive them this way. They are us, right? They look like us. They're you know, maybe, you know, some millions of years of evolution in the future from us, but they are us. And then we are being confronted with a mythology where the future us can't access this profound spiritual love. And to me, I say, like, whoa, okay, so there's a little parable, and, you know, that means that we now need to change our path so we don't go down that same road that these little scientific non-spiritual gray aliens with the big bald heads and the big black eyes, we don't go down that same path that they've gone down.
Yeah, boy, I mean, that's interesting. that's a great path to explore, because that's another theme that I hear over and over again in the UFO community and the UFO research community. And it's funny, because it has a very materialistic bent to it when you really process it all the way through. You know, it's along the same lines of, oh, it's about energy. You know, whenever I hear people in the UFO community talk about the energy systems, or they're trying to show us energy systems and all that, and it's like, I don't know, that just doesn't really fit well. In particular, you know, one of the things I'm just kind of interested in on the periphery here, and it doesn't really play in, but it does, but some of the recent developments with cold fusion and low energy nuclear reactions, which have now, you know, as we speak at this day, late December 2012, have pretty firmly been established that multiple labs, both in the US and Italy and other places, have shown that there is an effect there and that they can generate energy kind of almost in limitless fashion, and it'll be somewhat of a challenge to get that out, blah, blah, blah. Enough of that digression. But the point being that the simple, it's about energy, it's about energy systems, or they're trying to show us our energy systems, or they're trying to change our energy systems, just sounds so down materialistic back to, you know, let's play this game some more. Also, you know, you've heard we've just passed the 2012 Mayan calendar thing. Well, you know, spin back the clock a year or two ago and go listen to what people were saying, including many people in the UFO community. And they were saying all sorts of connections and links that, of course, never came to pass. Or jump over the other thing that just really kind of sends me off is the economic thing. It's the 2008 economic crisis that we're in. It's like, I mean, that's such an ethnocentric, ecocentric kind of view of things. I mean, there's other parts of the world that are doing great on a financial basis. So, you know, to kind of take our tiny little part of the world, whatever it is, or your local economy, and extrapolate that out to have some kind of huge, not just intergalactic, but spiritual kind of implications, to me seems kind of sketchy, as does this idea that the real narrative are these aliens and it's about souls and they don't have a soul and they're trying to regain a soul and all that. That suggests to me a deeper sense of knowing about the mind of God, for lack of a better term, than I would be willing to go. I mean, I don't know what all that means. I don't know what the white light means. I don't know what all the rest of that means. But it certainly means to me that, again, the message that we're getting back and all that is that this material reality that we have is a very, very limited kind of view of things. And I would put the alien soul stealing kind of hypothesis in that same category, because at the end of the day, it's all going up to one source. So how would that really play out in any way that's meaningful? That sounds to me like a very human kind of invention, that whole narrative.
You know, and once again, it's a Rorschach, you know, ink blot, you know, that we're staring at, you know, like it can, you know, you can paint it with whatever, I almost want to say whatever baggage you bring to it. You know, it's going to mirror back, you know, the avenue of research you go into, in a way. I mean, this is one of the things I've learned, is that everyone's got a different take on this phenomena, and very few people, I mean, whatever, nobody agrees on everything. So when you enter this community, and I'm just thinking of, like, you know, walking around at a UFO conference, nobody is going to be telling the same story. Nobody is going to have the same conclusions. And that is, but at the core, I believe there is a very real experience taking place. Oftentimes I'll say, that's the only thing I can say for sure, that something real is happening. Beyond that, it's all speculation on one level or another.
But we all have to speculate, right? I mean, that's kind of our job, if you will. Our job title here is speculators. That's the condition of being on Earth. But let me jump on that word a minute, experience and experiencer, because it pops up in our field over here in consciousness research, certainly in near-death experience research. And it always amazes me when I encounter folks who say, well, all I can tell you is that's my experience. And then they want to kind of end the conversation there and kind of put QED, I've solved it, you know, that's my experience. And I always find that interesting, because it seems so limiting in a way, and it seems like that what we really want to do, and this is what's so great about your work, is you really want to open up to as many of these experiences as possible and take them all in and gain from experiences that you're not going to have, because let's face it, we can't all have all these experiences. So you have to share with the experiences of others. And what I feel a need to do is kind of go one step further and realizing the dangers that lie within doing this, but try and understand those experiences somewhat scientifically. So I want to start sorting them, shifting them, sifting them, and then pulling them apart and trying to figure out where I can really feel more grounded in the reality of those experiences. And I really resist people who go, oh, no, 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 no. Don't step over that line. You don't want to do that. You don't want to apply those science. You can't really apply science to that. And it's like, of course we can. I mean, that's what we need to do, it seems to me, is we do need to filter out these experiences and try and understand them as best we can in this measurement of real, not real, probably somewhere in between.
Yep. Yeah. And now there's like one of the things that I'm doing is I'm making an effort to talk to people who purposely challenge me. And I'll say like the folks that are into the, you know, sort of fall into the new age camp. You know, like I'm challenged. Like my toes curl up in my shoes sometimes when I hear the things that they say. That doesn't make it wrong. That's just an emotional reaction I'm having to vocabulary words.
I can't help but jump over on the other side sometimes because there are some things we know, if you will. And let's talk for a minute about maybe some of the things we know. So we know there is a phenomena. We know there is some government knowledge of it. That's well documented in the best sourced material we can get, and that is their government's own documents and testimony from government officials. We know there's a deliberate attempt to misinform folks about what the government knows, whatever the government does know. What else do we know?
Okay, what else do we know? We know that there's physical evidence.
What else do we know?
Oh, here's another side that's making some notes here. When I talk to women that have had the UFO experience, the abduction experience, it seems that it's universal that 100% of the women will tell stories, whether this is a psychic phenomena, whether it's a totally physical phenomena, whether it's some blending of both. They will tell stories of strange pregnancies, missing fetuses, encounters on ships where they will interact with tiny babies, the implication, and then actually meeting hybrid children, hearing it telepathically through their encounter that this is their child. Now, like there's very little proof that this actually exists. There are some gynecological records that tell of odd pregnancies and, you know, that have stumped the doctors.
So let me just add, because I picked this up from an interview that you did, and I don't have any verification of this source, and I don't know if you do either, but the account is I was pregnant, I went to the doctor said I was pregnant, I returned to the doctor some period later, the doctor said, what happened? You're no longer pregnant. I don't know what happened. That doesn't seem true. This is clearly from your medical exam. You clearly had an abortion. What's going on here? And the doctor won't believe the patient, and that's where the kind of mystery kind of rest ends, right? Is that kind of it?
And often women will not be sexually active, and they'll be pregnant. You know, that's whatever, like few things in our society are more, you know, fraught with drama than, you know, virgin birth. But so there's that aspect to it too, where they will not be sexually active. They will, So I don't know. I can't prove. Well, who knows? I mean, like to perhaps someone's satisfaction that this is real. I'm going from the point that it is. It's almost. I mean, it's basically expected in my sense now. Like if I talk to a woman who claims the abduction phenomena, you know, one of the questions I'll ask is like, hey, have you had any odd experiences with pregnancies? And there'll be a pause in the phone or you know, and then she'll take a deep breath and she'll say, well, yes, here's what happened. So maybe this shouldn't be in the category of things we know for sure, but it is certainly in the category of a reoccurring pattern that is so defined that it is very difficult to ignore and dismiss.
Okay. Great. Anything else that we know?
We know that there's a, and this is going back to the fairy lore and stuff like that. We know that there's a record that stretches back, you know, before the modern age of the UFO phenomena that would tell of very similar stories. This is that word mythology again. We have it in our mythology that, you know, women with pregnant women are, you know, would be interacted, you know, fairies in a Celtic lore, elves in a more Nordic lore, trickster animals in a Native American lore, all would have an interest in pregnant women.
Well, that touches on this other thing that maybe falls into that category of what we know, and that's that the use of psychedelics, be they in a shamanic setting like ayahuasca or something like that, or in a clinical setting like the use of DMT by Rick Strassman in New Mexico, those experiences have yielded a lot of encounters with beings that map almost directly to the UFO experience. And some of the experiencers of ayahuasca down in Central America, Native people, are drawing pictures of, you know, flying saucers that they saw, and it's kind of uniform, or beings that look a lot like the beings that contactees report. So I guess that's something else, maybe in that category, like you said, not that we know, but that there is a high correlation between these two things.
Absolutely. And that's where it gets very, you know, murky, where you realize that there's an element to it. There's a physical element to it. You know, like people will say like, oh, the flying saucer landed in my backyard. I was escorted out of the house and, you know, taken on board the flying saucer. And then, you know, the researcher will show up and there'll be a burn mark in the backyard in you know, exactly where the person said it was. So we do have these kind of physical events, that can be documented by a researcher, and also very easily dismissed, or not easily dismissed, that are dismissed with some contempt by, you know, folks that don't want to look into this. But the whole psychedelic thing, you know, that paints a picture of something on a psychomystical realm that's also using the same characters. You know, the theater of the psychedelic experience has many of the same plot points and the same imagery that would be within the physical realm of these abduction cases.
That gets back to the most challenging part of all that is we don't understand the nature of that extended consciousness beyond our physical level. So whenever we talk about theater, then say, you know, is it theater to us or is it theater to them? Or, you know, I mean, whatever them is, and I don't just mean that in an alien sense. I mean that in a interdimensional, whatever that is that people are encountering under ayahuasca that isn't an illusion, or that, you know, because of course, backtracking a step, that is the conclusion of the one scientist that's done the most extensive work on this. That's Rick Strassman, well-respected scientific guy publishing in peer-reviewed journal. And his conclusion is that, one, they're not delusional, and two, that the encounters that they're having are with beings that seem to be freestanding beings that do have an ability to kind of move in this environment. So it kind of, on one hand, it defies completely our whole kind of reductionistic, scientific, materialistic kind of view of mind and consciousness. But heck, if we don't get past that, we can't get into any of these dialogues. But given that that's the case, then I think it all this stuff begs the question of, can we really understand this? Can we even talk about this extended consciousness in any way that's intelligent from our perspective, from where we are, from down here, if you will?
I'm not sure what to say. And then, I feel like I'm constantly confronted with, and the term I will use is something's going on behind the curtain. You know, I'm implying that there's this other dimensional realm that they, these aliens, can access, that we can barely access. Maybe we can access it through death. Maybe we can access it through psychedelics. Maybe we can access it through intense meditation, or through dream realms. You know, we can access that realm fleetingly. It's not like we're living in that realm. It seems to be that they either are in a partially physical realm, or they are in a partially mystical, spiritual, other dimensional realm that gets very, I feel like I'm searching for my words here, that gets very challenging to define simply because we are on this side of the curtain. I almost say that, like, I almost go back to like the mythological interpretations of the Garden of Eden, where, you know, I read one account where someone dissected the Garden of Eden, where it was basically the separation of man from the garden was the separation of man from that greater, grander knowing of that multidimensional realm. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that is something I sense, that we as humans are challenged confronting that realm. They, the aliens, are not. I'm simplifying that greatly just when I said that.
But I like that a lot. I think that while I wouldn't want to hang my hat on that, a lot of the evidence does seem to be pointing in that direction. And it does, in a way, kind of close the loop a little bit in terms of trying to understand how all these different experiences might fit together. So, Mike, maybe with that, it might be a good place to start wrapping this up. What other issues are pressing you in as you go forward with hidden experience?
I've had a set. This is very interesting. We've done this whole dialogue here, and I haven't really shared any of my own experiences, which felt great because, in a way, I feel like I've shared my experiences so many times that I kind of feel like I go on autopilot when I tell the stories, and I think that's a little unfair to anyone listening. But so I went to, this would have been in 2009. I went to a UFO conference. There was this woman, her name is Miriam Delicato. I've interviewed her on the site. She's had a lot of very strange experiences. I sat with her for a little while. And I was in a, I don't want to say, well, sure, the dark night of the soul is as good as any term. I was extremely challenged. These memories were welling up. I didn't know what to do with them. They were scary. They challenged my definition of reality. So I said, what do I do? You know, like, how do I proceed forward? And she very thoughtfully said, you should talk about you should talk more about this stuff. And, I drove back from the conference, and I literally, and I am not exaggerating, it felt like I was compelled by an outside source. I came home and started the blog almost, I don't even think I took my coat off after coming home from the conference. I, you know, pulled up into the driveway. It had been a long drive, you know, 18-hour drive. Came, sat right down at the computer and started the blog. Initially, the blog was just a collection of synchronicities, which I've had a lot of, and they make for very tidy, you know, they're perfect little blog postings, right? They're tidy. They got a little punchline at the end. And so I started posting those. At a certain point, I started posting some of the memories of my, what could be interpreted, and I'm doing it right now. I'm very shy to call myself, you know, give myself the label that I was so easily and callously labeling other people. So I've had experiences that might seem to, depending on how you look at it, fit the definition of UFO contact abduction. So there I went around the block rather than saying it outright because it is so weird. It's so challenging that I can't, it just would feel dishonest deep down if I called myself a UFO abductee. So I don't. I go right up to that line and maybe that's shallowness on my part. I don't know. But I started posting some of my memories online. In doing so, I was slammed with such crazy, overwhelming, impossible to ignore synchronicities that I was forced to deal with the reality of this. So it wasn't the memories. It wasn't the experiences. It wasn't the marks on my body that made me take this seriously. It was the synchronicities when I started sharing, when I started looking into my own experiences. It was the synchronicities that forced me to take this seriously. I was very capable of denying, you know, the stuff that has happened to me. I mean, very, very, you know, like I denied it outright for 45 years. And then in the last, so I'm 50 now, so in the last 5 years or so, I have looked into this in a way that obsession is a perfect term, obsessively. And
let me just jump in there with one thing, because I've heard you say that before. Why do you think your interest in this is obsessive? I think you're being too hard on yourself, and I think that I'd flip it around and say how anyone can ignore the huge implications that these questions have for their life, as I said before, on a day-to-day basis, and the way that you choose to live your life, to me seems to be really the part of a psychological condition that needs to be explained. That is, how can you ignore this stuff? How can we, you know, continue to kind of distract ourselves constantly, continuously with stuff that we know is total fluff and it doesn't have any real significance for our life. So I don't know. I have to challenge you on the idea of how do you think you're obsessive? Is it somehow disrupting your life or making your life really unsettled in some way?
Yes.
Okay. Then it's obsessive.
Yeah. I'm obsessed to the point where it has changed. Now, see, this is like, and I've talked to folks, and this is like the people who have had this experience. Well, I'm just parroting what they're saying because I've heard it. I'm saying it myself. And what happens is an old set of friends fades away. A new set of friends emerges.
Well, that happens the same thing happens to people when they just join the church or move from one church to another. And that's, I'm not a Christian, but I mean, I understand that experience.
Well, it feels a little obsessive to me because it has impacted my life. And it's funny because that's one of the things that I've talked to folks at, basically UFO conferences. I've talked to people on the phone and people who've been at this a lot longer than I have as far as the way they've, the path that they've been on. You know, they came to the realization years before I did. And I'll ask them, I'm like, oh God, I'm so mixed up. This is so challenging. I don't know what to think. And they look at me and they go, 3 years. Everyone goes through it. It takes 3 years. And I'm sort of at the tail end of that 3 years now, where I guess it's more like 5 years since I've really actively been looking into it. So, so that was actually very reassuring to have someone just say that to me, like, oh yeah, like everyone goes through that.
Right. Well, I hope you stay at it for a lot longer than that kind of time frame would suggest, because you do a great job. The interviews are great. I just hope I can get to them. They're somewhat lengthy, a lot of them, as this one has turned out to be. So you have to hang in there, but they're steady throughout. The content, the quality of it doesn't really go down. So I hope everyone checks out your interviews. They can find them at hiddenexperience.blogspot.com. You can subscribe to him on iTunes. Mike, it's been great having you on. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Thanks again to Mike for joining me today on Skeptico. I hope this interview got you thinking as much as it got me thinking, or really more than thinking, got me doing. And by doing, I mean doing more research, listening to more interviews, reading more books, and trying to understand as much as I can just what this phenomena is all about. So there's a couple of questions that I might tee up for discussion from this interview. The first is, what the heck is going on? What do you make of these reports of contact with this other consciousness, this alien consciousness? And keep in mind, if you haven't researched this very much, you need to dive into it a little bit, because what you'll find is really, really overwhelming evidence. You'll find evidence of, for example, Travis Walton, a guy who's out with five of his buddies and they're riding home and they all see up close a UFO. And one of the guys gets out, Travis Walton, and gets close enough to touch it. And when he touches it, boom, he's immediately zapped. Everyone else runs away. Travis Walton shows up naked 4 days later, having been abducted. What do you do with a report like that? And that's just one of many. But what do you do with a report where several solid witnesses have a shared report, all see the same thing, and then one person takes it further and says, no, there was contact associated with this? So again, there's many and many accounts like that. I think we're forced to either dismiss those all, write them all off. And the only reason to do that would be because we just can't deal with it, or we have to somehow figure out how we're going to incorporate those into our worldview. And it strikes me that we really haven't done that. We've put these people off in a subculture, and we call them the UFO community, and we want to just ignore everything that they're doing. It's just amazing to me how much we've compartmentalized the whole UFO phenomena, particularly from folks like us, if you will, who are interested in consciousness research. So that's a huge question, and that would be question number one. And question number two is equally big and far-reaching, and that's, what do you think is the relationship between this form of consciousness that these contactees are encountering and the other forms of extended consciousness that we've looked at on this show, be it near-death experience, out-of-body experience, remote viewing, psychedelics, the list goes on and on. What is your best guess as to what the connection is? Those are some pretty big questions. I can't imagine that we're going to get very far in really figuring it out, but I'd love to get your starting position, if you will, on that topic. And it's a topic that I certainly hope to delve into more and more in future episodes. So again, if you'd like to connect with me and talk about that, discuss those questions or any others, the place to do that is through the Skeptiko website at skeptiko.com. You'll find our forum through there, and you'll also find the comment section of our website where you can directly write a note. While you're at the Skeptiko website, be sure to check out our almost 200 previous interviews on a range of topics related to these kind of big picture questions that we find ourselves diving into. Well, that's going to do it for today. It's been a long show, but one that I'm really grateful to have done. It's been a very meaningful little step for me along the path to begin to explore this topic. I hope you're enjoying it too. Stick around. Much more to come on Skeptiko. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.